Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Thursday, May 23rd from HBR2. It's The Conversation. So how are you going to keep them down on the farm? Produce produce.
Wealthy wreckage winds back the clock.
Prescription prescribers need a pill to chill.
Stories that get to yes.
Plus the global view from Deutsche Welle. No junk, no shame in the backyard. And just who's flooded with concern in today's reality check.
Unemployment claims continue to drop in the U.S. Last week, the government processed 23,000 fewer applications than the week before, bringing down the overall total number of applications to a seasonally adjusted 340,000. The less volatile four-week average also fell slightly. That average has slid 9% since last November. New government figures show a surprisingly big drop in teen births among Hispanics. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports that the teen birth rate overall is now half what it was at its peak two decades ago.
In 2011, 31 out of 1,000 teens gave birth, according to the National Center for Health Statistics. The study shows an especially steep drop since the recent recession. It finds birth rates down in nearly every state and among both black and white women ages 15 to 19. But most striking, the birth rate for Hispanic teens fell at least 40% in nearly two dozen states. Among possible reasons why, public health experts point to the bad economy and a crackdown on illegal immigration. Jennifer Ludden, NPR. News, Washington.
Federal authorities are investigating a Boeing 747 that lost parts from its right wing as it was approaching Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport Sunday afternoon. The Federal Aviation Administration says the aircraft landed safely, but debris from the China Airlines flight reportedly landed on a woman's house. There were no reports of injuries. U.S. stocks lower with the Dow off 6 points. It's at 15,302. NASDAQ down 7 at 3456, and the S&P 500 down 6 points at 1650. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Los Angeles reduced emissions for its entire bus fleet by switching to natural gas. Thinkaboutit.org.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Tom McDonald has a farm, and no doubt he's tired of all the jokes. But the director of social ventures at Kahumana Community in Waianae grows more than just organic food. He helps grow people. The community's social programs for homeless families and people with developmental disabilities and autism are run by the nonprofit Alternative Structures International, started in 1974. Sustainability and public policy may again be the trend, but the mission of the community remains the same. And Tom McDonald joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, what you do at the farm may seem trendy, you know, programmatically and certainly with where we seem to be with public policy these days, but really it's coming out of some very old traditions and European influences and certainly intentional communities that we saw in the 60s and in the 70s.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, it was that first group of people. It was a professor and a priest. And you have to be careful about what happens when you get a professor and a priest in the same room talking about creating a community. But indeed, they did, a professor and a priest, and they joined with a carpenter, a cook, and a farmer. And they moved their the social program that they were running in Makiki and Waikiki and bought through a loan this 14-acre farm in 1978 and moved their social program out here. And it was their, in fact, it was their observation that fundamental to the problems that they were observing in families that were experiencing homelessness or people with developmental disability and mental illness was their disconnection with the land, and they wanted to create a community that provided both community support and a place where people could get reconnected to a farm as part of their therapy.
Tom, maybe the difference with this community is that it came from people who were local. This wasn't some sort of movement that just arrived in Hawaii and people plunked down and thought, oh, this sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, that's right. It was a local boy who went to Chaminade, and he got together with his professor, Father Phil Farman. He's still here living on the community and a very active part of our programs. His family's from Maui. And he was influenced by some of the intentional communities on the mainland and in Europe, Findhorn in Scotland and other such communities that he had read about or visited. And he saw that as very connected to the issues that were happening then and now in Hawaii. So he wanted to do something that was similar but uniquely kind of formed in the tradition, in the local traditions here.
The farm has certainly, you know, income-producing aspects to it, but they're there in support of what the farm is really all about, it seems, and that's all of the social programs, particularly for homeless families. And interestingly enough, a family, as you define it, is a family with children, and you got to have kids to get in. Is that true?
That's right. We're part of the continuity of care here in the state of Hawaii for homeless people, and our part of that continuity of care is specifically for homeless families with dependent children. And so we have a lot of single moms who are raising one or two or three kids on their own. We have families with kids. We have over 120 families and 500 people, so it's well over 300 keiki, and so it's a pretty lively place when all the kids come home from school.
I can imagine, and it stays that way for probably many hours afterward. But
yeah.
When you look at how this community has been developing over the last, you know, 35, 40 years,
right,
and where we are now, what we seem to be back to, I mean, it's almost a case of everything old is new again, isn't it, with the idea that somehow we have to connect our kids back to land?
It is, and, you know, the fact that there's more public awareness of that and public acceptance of it and support is a wonderful thing. You know, since Kahumana was founded 40 years ago, and when the people started thinking about this community about 50 years ago, the number of farms in America has gone from 6 million farms to 2 million farms. And so certainly over the life of this community, the problem has only gotten more acute. And I think you know, there are lots of wonderful trends here in Hawaii, especially with other nonprofits and with schools, and trying to connect people, you know, back to farming, back to the food they eat, back to the land. We should be able to grow everything that we eat in Hawaii.
Do these other organizations that are now sort of coming to this, I don't want to call them Johnny-come-latelys, because
yeah,
whoever does it, you know, and helps kids to understand where food comes from and let them feel dirt in their hands is probably a very good thing. But when they look at you, are you actively giving them advice how to do it and how to do it well, since you have four decades worth of experience?
Well, you know, all nonprofits, just like all companies, experience cycles of growth. And we were very focused for a long time as a relatively small facility caring for people with mental illness and developmental disability and autism. And as the homelessness problem became more acute in the in the early part of this century, we focused the attention of the nonprofit to address the homeless issues. And so, you know, we are constantly reinventing ourselves. I think we are a good resource for people who want to get into the nonprofit realm and try to connect their social programs to farming programs. It's not always a simple thing to do. You know, people who are addressing people and families who are addressing issues of homelessness, who have come across hard times financially, whose primary objective is to become self-sufficient, to get a job, to bring in that income, to bring in that $1,000, $1,200 a month. It's a challenge to get them to want to spend time growing their own food. And so I think, you know, we as a nonprofit community are learning from each other. And
Tom, I want to ask you about that issue of self-sufficiency, though, because you seem to model that for them in the way the farm runs, the way that you have your income structured so that some of it comes from state and federal funding, maybe a third of it.
Right.
And the other two-thirds come from the fees that families pay to be involved with those programs. They're not getting this stuff for free. And also all the other things that you have in support of the farm, obviously the produce and the cafe that's there, the retreat that you rent out, other things that you do to bring in income.
Yes, indeed. You know, only state and federal grants only pay for one-third of our total operating costs, and the other two-thirds have to come from the participants themselves. You know, the people in our programs contribute to the cost of their transitional program.
Right, which means to say that they're saying that you've got to be actively responsible for that and not simply just on the receiving end, which seems, again, to be the model of the farm. We wish you all the best with this, and thanks very much for what you've been doing out there. We'll look forward to hearing more from your programs as they develop in future.
Thank you so much.
Tom McDonald is the Director of Social Ventures at Kahumana Community in Waianae. The farm offers transitional housing for 120 homeless families with kids and a day program for people with disabilities. It employs and provides job training for the folks in those programs. And we just talked about where that partial funding comes from, including from some festivals, and one is happening this Saturday. Details are on the HPR2.org website. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. In this half hour, sailing trips and sunken ships, flooding from the foul canal. And now, take out your pencils. Here comes your quiz.
A beautiful instrument is more than just aesthetically pleasing, especially to the musician playing it. A Kohlwood ukulele may look nice, but unless it has just the right feel and sound, it could end up as a wall decoration. One world-renowned ukulele maker known for high-quality Koa instruments began with humble roots. His one-man business operated out of a basement in Kaimuki in 1916. Now, this company's instruments are preferred by ukulele virtuoso Jake Shimabukuro. One was also the choice of the late former Beatle, George Harrison. If you've seen the film 51st Dates, you might recall Adam Sandler serenading Drew Barrymore on a six-string model. A family-owned company, now in its third generation, is still committed to the guiding philosophy of their grandfather and founder, who said, if you make instruments and use the family name, don't make junk. Today's compound question for you, who said those words, and what's the name of this ukulele company? We'll play on and be back with the answer in about 20 minutes.
Aloha, I'm Kathy Betts from the Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women. You are tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
Sunken vessels don't have to be filled with gold doubloons to qualify as treasure. Each discovery of a submerged wreck in Hawaiian waters has a human drama in its background and a mystery story for historians to unravel. What was the accident or misadventure that sent a ship or a plane to the bottom, and what history does it reveal? Dr. Hans von Tilburg is a longtime chronicler of the wrecks found in Hawaiian waters, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Hans.
Good morning. Thank you, Chris.
It's good to have you.
It's nice to be here.
Are the Hawaiian Islands a particularly good area to study sunken wrecks?
Well, they're challenging because they're high-energy environments, mm-hmm. but yes, this is obviously a very maritime location.
Because there are a lot of wrecks, right?
That's right, and unfortunately a lot of vessels and also aircraft have splashed into these waters and remain as historic properties.
With the sailing vessels, is it just because of the currents and the reefs and just the general difficulty of navigating through these islands?
Absolutely. You probably know that there aren't many real safe anchorages or places you can shelter from the weather, mm-hmm. so you have to be pretty akamai to be able to survive in those kinds of trades, and there have been hundreds of years of contact.
We had obviously a lot of traffic because of the whaling industry in the 19th century. What was the first traffic after the Polynesians got here? What was the first ocean-going traffic out here?
Well, those would be very early Western vessels of discovery and trade, so people crossing the Pacific to China for commerce. And the whalers were close on their heels. The mm-hmm. whalers were out here very early, from the 1820 on.
Really?
Sure.
And because in those days, it was big business, right?
That's right. That's right. Whale oil was, in a sense, our first energy industry.
Mm-hmm. What are the oldest vessels that have been found in these waters?
The oldest shipwreck is a British whaler known as the Pearl, sailing in consort with the Hermes, and they were wrecked in 1822.
Wow.
Up at Pearl and Hermes Atoll. And they were discovered by some NOAA divers years ago, and they've investigated the wreck site, and it's been very interesting.
So that these kind of wrecks continue to yield new information even years after they're found, yeah?
Yeah. I think most people think that wrecks are you know, fun to discover for sport divers, and they are that, but they also do have historical and archaeological information.
Sure.
And that can be gleaned from the tools and the artifacts on those sites.
What are some of the clues that you might find?
Well, you can find the equipment that operated the ship, the winches, the windlasses, the anchors, and that has a whole history unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's personal cargo or navigation equipment associated with wreck sites. But also just identifying the vessel or aircraft adds a little bit of history that otherwise, you know, isn't written down in any book.
Well, say a vessel that went down, obviously its log will be lost, but there'll be records from, say, a shipping company or somewhere else, right, of whatever happened to this particular vessel.
Sometimes. And if you can find those, you know, you have more of the picture of what happened. But often those documents are scattered and hard to locate.
I would imagine, yeah. But that's the whole sort of land-based detective story aspect of all this, right?
That's right.
Tracking down records.
Yeah. I enjoy that one myself. The hunt isn't just, you know, underwater for these historic properties and sites, mm-hmm. but also sometimes in the archives.
Well, I mean, anytime a ship goes down, it has an enormous ripple effect on the crew, the whoever sent the ship out in the first place, be it a Navy or a private, like a whaling company. It sort of has an impact all over the place. It's a question of finding out where that impact was felt. Yeah.
You know, for local vessels, a lot of small steamers, when they sank with plantation cargo and sugar, it could have a pretty big economic impact to the plantations here.
Sure. Well, and that's a whole, you know, the economy of the Sandwich Islands, Kingdom of Hawaii, 19th century was largely, I mean, whaling was very important up to about, what, mid-century, and then all of a sudden it declined rapidly in importance, didn't it?
It began to decline in the 1850s, mm-hmm. you know, when the populations of the species had been fairly decimated, unfortunately, and also with the discovery of petroleum and kerosene after that, but continued on into the 1890s, actually, up in the Arctic.
But it was kind of a fading. I mean, and you see signs of that as well. And
yeah, it was on the downturn.
Do you have any sort of preferred vessels that you've heard about that you'd like to find? You know, is there sort of a holy grail of sunken ships out there for you?
Well, you know, I'm fascinated by Hawaii's plantation history, but in terms of the resources that are out there, I have to tell you that the aviation history Hawaii has underwater is striking, and you have to understand the position of Hawaii back in the 1930s and 40s in the war years and what that meant to have all those squadrons practicing here and accidents happened.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Planes were lost. So if you just count the number of aircraft between 1924 and 1952, there are over 1,485 naval aircraft in the waters around the Hawaiian archipelago.
My gosh. How many have been found? Those are the ones that have been recorded
and recorded as lost. There's a brief report filed, but we probably know about where 36 or so of those are.
So this is a function of the fact that a lot of training was done here. So
lots of intensive training, absolutely. Had a commitment to that period of time in the Pacific.
So not just pilots, but even the aircraft were perhaps untested when they were being flown in these waters, yeah?
Absolutely right.
Well, that's there's a lot in aviation history. There's a history that sort of resonates out from that, isn't there?
Sure. It's a fascinating history, and those were very brave people that took that on.
How do you go about your work? Mainly through diving, photographing, matching up with records when you're on land. Is that kind of the essence of your work?
Well, my work, when it includes, survey for sites, begins in the archives with defining a survey area.
Uh-huh.
And then proceeds to a phase called remote sensing with a magnetometer or side-scan sonar to find the location. It's a big ocean out there.
So you really have to sort of start to get a general idea before you even start diving and looking, right?
Sure. You want to narrow down the survey area as much as you can.
Well, Hans, thanks very much for coming on the show. It's really fascinating work that you do, and I appreciate you talking with us.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been my pleasure, and I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Great. Good. Especially when you find anything new. Give us a holler, right?
All right.
Anything old or anything new.
Okay.
Dr. Hans von Tilburg is the Maritime Heritage Coordinator and the Unit Diving Supervisor for the NOAA Office of National Marine Sanctuaries. His research will be discussed on an upcoming episode of the PBS Digital Studio series, Under H2O, and you can link to it through our HPR2.org website.
Don't talk too much. Don't know too much. Jack, don't be too hip, cause a slip of the lip might sink a ship. Don't see too much, boy. Don't jive too much, Jack. Don't be so hip, cause a slip of the lip might sink a ship. The walls have ears, the night has eyes. So let's be wise.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from St. Andrew's Priory School for Girls, offering a K-12 college preparatory curriculum that integrates arts, sciences, and technology. Currently accepting applications. Priory.net.
Talk of the Nation provides you with the day's news and more, the experiences and opinions of people around the country and around the world. I'm Neil Conan. When you're looking for the latest news and how it affects you, your family, your neighbors, and your life, turn to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Weekday mornings from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Kwan Sui and Helen Mao of Honolulu, Sarah Kleppel of Honolulu, and Jill Nakayama of Kailua for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing that you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We're coming up to 8:28. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Kauai Canal is fed by urban runoff and water from streams in Manoa, Palolo, and Makiki. But can the Alawai withstand a major rainstorm or flood? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Hi there, Chad.
Hello, Beth Ann.
I guess we could be really quick with this one and say no, but there's a lot of work behind that.
Yeah, the short and sweet answer, the reality check, if you will, is no. Like he could not withstand a major rainstorm or flood. Let me, let me just read the opening sentences of Sophie Cox's article today. It's the last in our series on the Alawai. Picture, if you will. Frothy brown water filled with the sediment and trash from hundreds of homes and businesses would surge into the Alawai Canal. The canal would soon top its banks, and a flood of major proportion would bury Waikiki in a wall of water that could reach 5 feet high. Then the story goes on to say basements and parking garages would fill, power lines, sewer lines, water service would be out potentially for days, if not longer. So this is a real scenario. Mind you, it's a once in 100 years kind of flood, but it does happen. That's why they call it once in 100 years. So the short answer is Waikiki is not prepared for a serious rainstorm or flood regarding the Alawai Canal.
And we had sort of, I don't want to say a taste of this, but certainly a very real example when we had the flooding in Manoa several years ago, where the stream became so crowded with all kinds of debris. Cars were washed away, basements flooded. Certainly UH got a big part of that,
serious
too.
Serious damage
and
to
all
Hamilton
that
Library.
Damage, yeah, didn't seem to change the way we look at other possible scenarios of the same kind of damage.
And by the way, the canal has itself, its banks have overflowed at least twice in recent history, in 1965 and in 1967, and Sophie uncovered evidence. Cars were stranded, pedestrians were wading through knee-deep water. It is really described as catastrophic should this happen, but we are not prepared for that, even though federal and state officials know about this problem. As usual, it comes down to the concerns about money. Where do we put our resources?
Or we just seem to have a really good forgettery, and we don't understand that when it happens, it's pretty intense. And it's the same way that we feel complacent about any other disaster that might happen. I mean, how many people really prepare by having enough food or water and all the rest of it until they find themselves in trouble? But this would be trouble for a whole lot of people for a whole long period of time. The Army Corps of Engineers has said it would be catastrophic. Why don't we take this to the next step, Chad, from what you've been finding?
It really is money. The Army Corps actually has a plan. They say you should probably put 13-foot high walls around the Alawai. You ought to build a new bridge at the Macaulay area. You need to deepen the canal substantially, but that would cost at least $100 million. And as you know, federal and state funds are scarce these days.
But at some point, if we have to really deal with it, we're going to be paying that money anyway just to clean up and to redo it anyhow. And one day that's going to strike, and we all know it, but we don't want to pay much attention to it, it seems.
That's right.
All right, Chad, we'll go at it one more time with the Alawai tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth, and I'll talk to you then.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook. Coming up this half hour, legally approved drug abuse, six-string sound, and LGBTYES. Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be talking on Town Square about a subject close to many hearts.
Well, yeah, and one we haven't talked a whole lot about because it seems as if it fell off the headlines for a little while there. Not that we wouldn't pay attention to that, but here you go in 8 words. The mayor, the head of heart, and rail. And we can add a couple more to that and your phone calls too.
Instantly, emotions and phone calls are generated by just those words, aren't they?
Well, and people want to know where we're going with the second half of rail and why, you know, there's not enough information in some cases flowing out. We've had lots of calls about this. I'm sure we'll have lots more when we go to air tonight at 5 o'clock.
It's funny how news stories sort of die down and then have a resurgence, and we'll keep you abreast of what's going on with rail tonight at 5.
Real time, real live access. Is there a difference in the cost of drugs bought in your doctor's office and those you get filled in a pharmacy? Managed care advocate Joe Peduta says yes, and it's more than just your pocket money. The impact of marked up, repackaged drugs just might give docs an incentive to prescribe and, however unwittingly, might mean they could be writing a prescription for drug abuse. Joe Peduta is in Hawaii to speak at next week's Drug Summit, and he joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been talking about issues of prescription drug abuse for a while. Some have sort of migrated into Hollywood, into the lexicon of many of the shows that we see. People, you know, short circuit names and truncate, you know, oxy for oxycodone. We seem to have an idea that these things are not good, not being well traced. Are we really focusing enough attention on them right now?
I don't believe so. There's a couple of different issues here. One is there's been a tremendous growth in the use of opioid narcotics, OxyContin, oxycodone, Vicodin, Percocet are some of the brand names. And as a result, there's been tremendous growth in abuse and in crime related to that. Unfortunately, this has found itself into the workers' compensation area as well. It's the only business where physicians in Hawaii can actually dispense quite a bit of the drugs that are going to injured workers. And obviously, when there's opioids being dispensed to an injured worker, there's an increased risk of abuse, misuse, diversion, et cetera. So the combination of the growth in opioid usage in the United States and in Hawaii specifically, and the expansion of physician dispensing within Hawaii certainly could lead to significant additional problems.
Problems for the business, problems for the patient, problems all around.
Certainly. There's the biggest issue with physician dispensing of drugs is that physicians do not have access to the databases that retail pharmacies do. Retail pharmacy databases are all interconnected, so if a patient's getting a drug at one pharmacy and there's a contraindication because of a drug that they're getting another, there's a very good chance that the pharmacist is going to know that, understand that, explain that to the patient, contact the physician, and recommend a change. If the physician is dispensing the medication, there's no way that the physician is going to know what other drugs they're taking. Now, the physician certainly can ask the patient there, but in a lot of cases, patient recall of the drugs that they're taking isn't very good at all. So there's an additional risk that there's some sort of drug-to-drug interaction. On the employer side, the city of Honolulu has seen costs are significantly higher, several hundred thousand dollars mm-hmm. higher for drugs that are dispensed by physicians than the same drugs, the exact same medications, if they're dispensed in a retail pharmacist. So this is adding to the tax burden for the citizens of Honolulu and the citizens of Hawaii, and also it's increasing workers' compensation premiums.
All of that said, this is another reason why, for example, Chuck Schumer of New York, Senator from New York, wants to see a drug like hydrocodone become a Schedule II drug, and is prepared to introduce legislation to do just that. Are we going to see these drugs tightened up a bit in our access to them?
We certainly hope so. That's not to say that there's not a subset of the population of patients that absolutely need opioids from time to time. I had to go through shoulder surgery the other day, fell off my bike, was hit by a dump truck, and I got to tell you that opioids really helped for 2 or 3 days. On the other hand, folks who are on opioids over the long period, say 6 to 9 months, are at extremely high risk for addiction, dependency, and all the risks that go along with that. When you look at the national statistics, CDC indicates that about 15,000 people last year died of quote-unquote accidental drug poisoning. The vast majority of those were due to opioid overdoses. You're killing almost as many people with drugs that you're killing with motor vehicles. Clearly, we've reached epidemic proportions, and in fact, that's what the CDC refers to that. So Senator Schumer's actions are laudable and certainly timely, if not a bit late.
A bit late. And I would ask you the same question about doctors' awareness of this, because this is not a new issue. Don't most doctors really understand this at some level, that this is not necessarily the best course of treatment for a patient over the long haul?
I think doctors understand that from an intellectual perspective.
But not practically.
But Well, from a practical perspective, doctors, especially in workers' compensation, they may not understand all the issues inherent in opioid overdosing, opioid dosing, et cetera. Doctors don't get a tremendous amount of training around pharmacology and specifically around opioids and opioid narcotics. As a result, they don't have anywhere near the training that a pharmacist does. So in actuality, what happens is doctors are dispensing. They think they know what's going on. But when you look at the research, it's clear that a lot of doctors aren't aware that they're actually adding to the risk that these patients are going to accumulate.
At this point, should doctors just not be prescribing drugs that they themselves can dispense in their own offices?
I don't believe that there is any evidence. In fact, I know that there is no evidence that physicians dispensing drugs in any way, shape, or form helps patients in any way. The data from the California Work Comp Institute actually proves that patients who have doctor-dispensed repackaged drugs stay out of work longer, cost more money, and drive up medical costs. In fact, the additional medical cost incremental to each drug that is dispensed is almost $500. So if a patient gets four or five drugs, you're talking an additional $2,000 or $2,500 that employer has to pay, and in the case of the city of Honolulu, the taxpayers have to pay. Now, there's no justification for that in terms of improved patient care. In fact, it's clear that patient care is not as good when physicians actually dispense drugs.
But
unfortunately, the only reason for physicians to dispense drugs that's been demonstrated is to make a lot of money.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. The incentive to make money is going to be a tough one to put down unless something becomes just patently illegal. How likely are we to see that?
Well, unfortunately, there's been quite a bit of lobbying activity on the part of physician dispensing companies and their allies, and it's certainly been reported on by Rob Perez and other folks in Hawaii, and money talks. So Clayton Hee, unfortunately, did not see fit to put forth legislation or hear legislation that would have dealt with this problem and, again, save taxpayers a significant amount of money. He also was a recipient of somewhere around $30,000 in campaign donations from folks affiliated with the physician dispensing industry. I'm not saying that there's a cause and effect. I'm just noting a couple of facts there.
Nor are we saying that all doctors who do this are doing it to make money and line their pockets a little bit more. But if this is, in fact, as you say, as demonstrable as it has been, is what you've told them in California and said around the country, and with a movement toward reclassifying hydrocodone and looking at opioids in a very different way, can you just sort of look out and see what kind of legislation we might see coming down the pike nationally in the next 2 years?
Well, I think what we're going to see in Washington, assuming that Washington does anything about anything, which may be a bit of an assumption, is that we're going to see stronger reporting regulations around the post-marketing surveys of opioids. We're going to see stronger label warnings. We're going to see restrictions on off-label use of some of these more potent opioid narcotics. Mm-hmm. And potentially also some model legislation coming out of some of the legislative bodies around encouraging physicians to be more conscious of the potential negative effects of dispensing opioids. One of the problems in a number of states is that patients can bring a formal complaint to the medical board, if they do not believe that their physician is, quote, treating their pain appropriately, unquote. And that is a significant problem. As a result, a lot of doctors feel like they just have to treat it, otherwise they might get a formal complaint. So we've got to change those laws to make it more to protect doctors if they decide that, gosh, this just isn't, this patient isn't a good candidate for extended use of these drugs.
Joe, I wish we had more time to talk to you about it, but you'll be here next week. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Look forward to it. Thanks so much.
Joe Peduta is a nationally recognized managed care advocate and the principal of consulting firm Health Strategy Associates. His focus, as we've been talking about, is on physician-dispensed repackaged drugs and the consequences of over-prescribing opioids. He'll be speaking in Hawaii next week at the Prescription Drug Summit.
Hi, good morning. I'm Dan Burden from the Walkable and Livable Communities Institute. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Earlier in the show, we stopped to consider some world-class koa ukulele chosen by an ukulele master and even a former Beatle. And we asked you to give us two names, the company's and its founder. Instruments from this company were first built in a Kaimuki basement. Now in its third generation of family operation, its home is an expanded factory on South Street. You may have seen and heard an example built out of the tradition of its founder in the film 51st Dates. So, what company crafts such renowned instruments? We won't string you along any further. It's the Kaimaka Ukulele Company, founded by Samuel Kaimaka in 1916. That's the quiz for today. If you've got one for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You know a theatrical presentation is telling a true story when it uses the life histories and the words of the people whose story is being told. It's especially effective with a community that has been marginalized for whatever reason, because theirs are stories that aren't told often enough. Yes, I Am, a collection of stories from Honolulu's LGBT community, is just such a presentation. And Ron Gilliam is the director. He's with us in CR7 this morning. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You've woven dramatic structure out of oral histories, right? First-person stories?
Yeah. The process of this play has been going out into the community with individuals from that community. For this particular production, it was for the LGBT community in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. And we went out and we collected stories from individuals from every part of the acronym, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. And we brought those stories back and we created a new performance, original performance out of them.
How do you put, you know, none of these were planned. You didn't say to somebody, okay, you're in act two and this is the action that's going on around you. So you have very disparate materials. How do you pull them together into something that makes sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. For this production, we actually used kind of a large storyboard. So mm-hmm. I had mentioned to you earlier, before the show, we used a storyboard and kind of clipped out parts of the script from lots of the interviews that we had that would make the initial or the final script.
Kind of physically cutting and pasting,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. It took a long time. It was a pure month of, we've been working on this show for 3 months. It has been a pure month of just structuring the script. And I think we got the full structure about 2 weeks ago.
Give me an idea of maybe one of the anecdotes that was told in this, just to give me a flavor of it.
You know, surprisingly, maybe I'll give a story that was very surprising to everyone.
Uh-huh.
Coming into this. You know, a lot of us believe that Honolulu is a very safe place, that there's no need to worry about just personal safety.
A climate of acceptance you wouldn't find
in
another city, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
However, a large majority of the stories were about safety. Being scared to be who you are.
Being a target of violence because of who you are.
Yes, yes. So, you know, for example, we have one story that's being told about a couple who had been married, two men, and who were beaten near Queens Beach just walking on the street, and no one helped these two couples from this bashing that occurred. And it was talking the stories about the empowerment and how they dealt with that and their own issues of personal safety. There's other ones as well. That's just one that stands out in particular. And however, you know, that is one negative story. There's also humorous stories as part of this production as well. It's definitely not all negative.
But there is that shared experience of a lot of people in this community of having somebody just take a look at you and come after you, right?
Yes, yes. I think that's why mostly that the LGBT community has come together as a group, and why we as a community are very accepting of individuals who don't consider part of kind of normal or normative society.
What is that thing of feeling, you know, that kind of violent rage toward a complete stranger whose life is none of your business? I mean, what you must have heard some speculation as to why do people do this, and as you collect these stories, do you have any thoughts being offered in that area?
Yeah, actually, you know, I think that's a great question. I think this play is aiming to kind of change individuals' perceptions of the community. And I think that a lot of times this type of violence that occurs is actually because of a misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And that is the root of the problem, is just a common misunderstanding. So hopefully with work like this that is through Playbuilders, that uses original stories, you know, people from that community to create an artistic work, we are going to be bridging, you know, communities, bridging the audience with these individual stories. And I think even people from the LGBT community themselves, they're going to be pretty surprised with these stories, how powerful they are, how they resonate with them, and they're going to learn some things as well, too.
Well, I mean, and I don't want to overemphasize the grim stories, but obviously that is a common thread. Mm-hmm. But it also, you're aiming at showing that this is also a life, you know, for a lot of people that brings them joy. And you're saying there's humor and that is in it as well.
Yes, yes. There's lots of jokes and humorous life stories. I mean, the piece itself is mostly about storytelling. It is stories of these individuals. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of humorous stories of coming out to your family members, issues with your first partner, trying to negotiate how
sure.
you do what, you know.
The various difficulties of kind of growing up, finding out who you are,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Well, you also find in any community that's marginalized, and is that a fair term to use?
Yes, yes,
LGBT
I think so.
Communities, you find in communities that are marginalized that they do turn to humor as a kind of mutual support and kind of almost a salvation, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that you know, oftentimes we will laugh at instances within these stories, but sometimes it's a nervous laugh because it's a way that you deal with some serious social issues such as violence or acceptance or learning who you are. And I hope that we're creating an environment where people who are not even part of the LGBT community can watch the performance and still laugh with us, you know, at this performance as well.
But, you know, it's interesting, Ron, to hear you say, I mean, I would expect to hear you say that people from outside the community will learn from this show, but you're saying that people inside the community will learn from this
yes,
show.
Yes, yes.
That's an interesting dimension, don't you think?
Yeah, I think, like I said, a lot of individuals that were collecting the stories are part of that community, are part of the community, and they were very surprised when we were getting a lot of stories about physical violence. So because people had in the main group may have not have experienced physical violence, mm-hmm. or they maybe experienced their life differently. We all have a unique lived experience. So it is supposed to be a production where there's going to be a lot of discovery and learning. And hopefully everyone by the end will get something out of it to lead to more acceptance for this community.
Well, it certainly sounds as if it's a production that has been educational for all concerned. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That's great. And thanks very much for talking with us on the show this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Ron Gilliam is the director of Yes, I Am, a collection of stories from Honolulu's LGBT community. It'll be performed for 2 weekends, starting a week from tomorrow at Fresh Cafe in Honolulu. And details are on our new website, hpr2.org.
Mango Season's debut in HPR's Atherton at 7:30 on Saturday, June 1st, will feature the release of the group's first CD, Flying Home. The Kickstarter-funded album is a sampling of the sun-kissed island soul jazz born of their travels and stories. The evening celebrates flying home with 9 original new works and 5 cover songs sung in 5 different languages. For reservations, call 955-8821 during business hours.
Prescription drugs, all too easy to get a hold of, prescription painkillers for, you know, a root canal that might leave you with 20 powerful painkilling drugs left over.
Left over and perhaps looking to be taken by somebody, not necessarily you, but
yeah.
You know, some of this stuff finds its way into the black market, which is why, you know, we have national days where you can go and bring back your drugs. But all that aside, the movement to get people back to work quickly and the backlash of all that, plus getting access to the drugs as quickly as possible, sometimes in a doctor's office, is all about what Joe Peduta is cautioning us to take a look at right now.
There really needs to be a kind of a sea change in our attitude toward painkillers, because there's obviously a wide use beyond their specific purpose, right?
And counterindications that sometimes people really don't know unless there's an electronic record, which was the whole point about having electronic records in the first place. But a lot of doctors' offices and even doctors that are connected to various medical centers don't necessarily have access to that yet.
Well, it's a time that needs to come, isn't it?
Well, while we're talking about what's coming, we're going to tell you what's coming up at 9 o'clock on HBR2. We'll be replaying the speech President Obama gave earlier this morning about his administration's approach to the war on terror. That was a speech at the National Defense University. And for us tomorrow, Hawaii's legal limit for blood alcohol is too high, according to a national agency. Senator Josh Green has a lot to say about that, too, and we'll hear it.
And a celebration of Polynesian traditions from throughout the Pacific.
You can talk back to your radio and continue the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at Because HPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, you can go to our HPR2.org website. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.